Chapter 6. The Jayanati Step. It is said, a man is born of his mother and is fed of his mother. Then he is fed of the land, and the land passes through him, taking and giving a pinch of dust each time, until man is no longer of his mother, but of the land. Skilvendi Proverb. And in old Shaikh, the language of the ruling and religious castes of the Nansorium, Skilvenus means catastrophe or apocalypse, as though the Skilvendi have somehow transcended the role of peoples in history and become a principle. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Early summer, 4110, year of the Tusk, the Jayanati Steppe. Neyur Uz Skiotha found the king of tribes and the others crowded across a ridge that afforded them a panoramic view of the Hathanta Mountains and the Nansor army encamped below. Pulling his gray to a stop, he studied them from a distance, his heart hammering as though his blood had grown overthick. For a moment, he felt like a boy excluded by his elder siblings and their snide friends. He half expected to hear taunts sailing on the wind. Why would they disgrace me like this? But he was not a child. He was the many-blooded chieftain of the Utamot, a seasoned Skilvendi warrior of more than 45 summers. He owned 8 wives, 23 slaves, and more than 300 cattle. He had fathered 37 sons, 19 of the pure blood. His arms were ribbed with the swazond, ritual trophy scars of more than 200 dead foes. He was Neyur, breaker of horses and men.
I could kill any of them, pound them to bloody ruin, and yet they affront me like this. What have I done?
But like any murderer, he knew the answer. The outrage lay not in the fact of his dishonor, but in their presumption to know. Flaring between snow-capped peaks, the sun bathed the assembled chieftains in pale morning gold. They looked like warriors from different nations and ages, despite the spiked Kianin battle caps worn by the veterans of the Battle of Zerkerta. Some sported antique scale corselets, others male hauberks and cuirasses of varying manufacture, the spoils of long-dead Inrithi princes and nobles. Only their scarred arms, stone faces, and long black hair marked them as the people, as Skilvendi. Zunarit, their king of tribes by election, sat in their midst, his left arm braced imperiously on his thigh, his right raised to the distance. As though at his direction, the rider next to him raised the indented crescent of his bow. Neyur glimpsed a birch arrow sailing across the sky, saw it vanish in the grasses part way to the river. They measured distances, he realized, which could only mean they planned their assault.
Without me.
Could they have simply forgotten? Cursing, Neyur urged his mount toward them. He kept his face turned to the east, sparing himself the indignity of their smirking looks. The river Kayuth wound across the valley floor, black save where frosted by shallow rapids. Even from this distance, he could see the Nansor army teeming along its banks, chopping down the remaining poplars, dragging them away with teams of horses. Fortified by earthworks and a palisade, the imperial encampment lay a mile or so beyond, a great oblong of innumerable tents and wains beneath the mountain the memorialists called Sakthuta, the Two Bulls. 3 days ago, he'd been astonished and appalled by this sight, for the Nansor to trespass was outrage enough, but to sink posts and raise walls as well? Now, however, it filled him only with foreboding. Baring his teeth, he barreled into the midst of his brother chieftains.
Zunarit!
He bellowed.
Why wasn't I summoned?
The king of tribes cursed and yanked his roan about to face him. The morning breeze dimpled the fox fur trim of his Kianin battle cap. Regarding Neyur with undisguised contempt, he said,
You were summoned like the rest, Utamot.
Neyur had met Zunarit only 5 days earlier, shortly after arriving with his Utamot warriors. Their dislike had been mutual and immediate, like that of suitors for the same beauty. Zunarit's contempt, Neyur had no doubt, was rooted in the scandalous rumors of his father's death long ago. The grounds of his own animosity, however, eluded him. Perhaps he'd simply matched disdain with disdain. Perhaps it was the silk trim of Zunarit's fleece tunic or the ingrown vanity of his smile. Hatred needed no reasons, if only because they were so many and so easily had.
"We shouldn't attack," Neyur said bluntly. "This is juvenile foolishness."
Disapproval hung like musk in the morning air. The other chieftains scrutinized him, their faces guarded. Despite the rumors they had doubtless heard, Neyur's flayed arms demanded a grudging deference. Not a man among them, Neyur knew, had murdered half as many as he. Zunarit leaned forward and spat across the grasses, a gesture of disrespect.
"Foolishness! The Nensor shit, piss, and poke asses on our hallowed land, Utamot. What would you have me do, parley? Capitulate and send confess tribute?"
Neyur debated whether to discredit the man or to discredit his scheme.
"No,"
he replied, opting for wisdom instead of slander.
"I would have us wait. We have Aikuri confess."
He raised a thick-fingered hand and clenched it into a fist.
"Trapped! His horses need rich fodder. Ours do not. His men are accustomed to roofs, to pillows, to wine, and to the comforts of lax women, while ours sleep in their saddles and need only their horses' blood for sustenance. Mark me, as the days pass, the fawn will begin sprinting through their hearts and the jackal through their bellies. They will fear and they will hunger. Their fortifications of earth and timber will smack more of captivity than safety, and soon desperation will drive them to a ground of our choosing."
A low-throated rumble passed through the assembled chieftains, and Neyur glanced from face to weathered face. Some were young and eager to shed blood, but most possessed the sturdy wisdom of many campaigns, older faces such as his own. They were men who had survived the many impatiences of youth and yet remained in the prime of their strength. They could see the wisdom of his words. But Zunarit looked unimpressed.
"Always the tactician, eh, Utamot? Tell me, Neyur Uskiotha, if you entered your yaksh and found men assaulting your wives, what tactics would you adopt? Would you wait in ambush outside where you'd be most certain of success? Would you wait until after they desecrated both hearth and womb?"
Neyur sneered, noticing for the first time the two missing fingers on Zunarit's left hand. Could the fool even draw a bow?
"The foot of the Helfantis is a far different thing than my yaksh, Zunarit." "Is it? Is this what the memorialists tell us?"
It wasn't so much the man's cunning that shocked Neyur as the realization that he'd underestimated him. Zunarit's eyes flashed with triumph.
"No. The memorialists say that battle is our heart, earth our womb, and sky our yaksh. We've been violated, as surely as if confess had quickened our wives or cracked our hearthstone. Violated, desecrated, humiliated. We are beyond measuring tactical advantages, Utamot."
"And what of our victory over the Fenum at Zerkurta?" Neyur asked. Most of the men present had been at Zerkurta 8 years before, where he himself had struck down Hazjanet, the Kianine general.
"What of it? How long did the tribes fall back before the Kianine? How long did we bleed them before we broke their back?"
He graced Zunarit with a macabre smile, the one that so often reduced his wives to tears. The king of tribes stiffened.
"But that is a different thing, Zunarit? How can a battle be like a yaksh and yet not be like another battle? At Zerkurta, we practiced patience. We waited, and by doing so, we utterly destroyed a powerful foe."
"But it's not simply a matter of waiting, Neyur,"
a third voice called out. It was Akne One-Eye, the chieftain of the powerful Munuati tribes from the interior.
"The question is one of how long we must wait. Soon the droughts begin, and those of us from the steppe's heart must drive our herds to summer pasture."
Numerous shouts followed the remark, as though this were the first sensible thing said.
"Indeed," Zunarit added,
rallied by this unsought support.
Confis has come heavily laden, with a baggage train larger than his army. How long would you have us wait for the fawn and jackal to gnaw at their hearts and bellies? 1 month? 2? Even 6?
He turned to the others and was rewarded by a swell of guttural assent. Nayor ran a hand over his scalp, sorted through the hostile faces surrounding him. He understood their worries because they were also his. An overlong absence possessed many perils. Neglected herds meant wolves, pestilence, even famine. If one added to this the threat of slave revolts, wayward wives, and for tribes on the steppe's northern frontier such as his own, Srank, then the incentive for a hasty return became irresistible. He turned to Zunarit, realizing the decision to attack was not something the man had foisted on the others. Even though they knew that haste was the curse of wisdom, they wanted to bring this war to a quick conclusion, far more so than they had at Zerkerta. But why? All eyes were on him.
Well?
Zunarit asked. Had Ikuri Confess intended this? It would be easy enough, he supposed, to learn the different demands the seasons placed on the people. Had Confis deliberately chosen the weeks before the summer drought? The thought dizzied Nayor with its implications. Suddenly, everything he had witnessed and heard since joining the Horde possessed different meaning. The buggery of their Skilvendi captives, the mocking embassies, even the positioning of their privies, all calculated to gall the people into attacking.
Why?
Nayor abruptly asked.
Why would Confis bring so many supplies?
Zunarit snorted.
Because this is the steppe. There's no forage.
No, because he expects a war of patience.
Exactly,
Zunarit exclaimed.
He intends to wait until hunger forces the tribes to disband, which is why we must attack immediately. Disband?
Nayor cried, dismayed that his insight could be so easily perverted.
No! He intends to wait until hunger or pride forces the tribes to attack!
The audacity of the claim provoked shouts from the onlookers. Zunarit laughed in the rueful manner of one who'd mistaken naivete for wisdom.
You Utamot dwell far from the Empire,
he said as though indulging a fool.
So, perhaps ignorance of imperial politics is to be expected. How could you know that the stature of Ikuri Confess grows while that of his uncle, the Emperor, falters? You speak as though Ikuri Confess were sent here to conquer when he's been sent here to die. Do you jest?
Nayor cried in exasperation.
Have you looked at his host? Their elite cavalry, their Norserai auxiliaries, well nigh every column in the Imperial Army, even the Emperor's own Eothic Guard. They've stripped the Empire to assemble this expedition. Treaties must have been struck, fortunes of gold promised and spent. This is an army of conquest, not a funeral procession for... Ask the memorialists,
Zunarit snapped.
Other emperors have sacrificed as much, if not more. Zarius would have to fool Confis, would he not? Pah! And you say the Utamot know nothing of the Empire. The Nansurium is a place besieged. She could ill afford to lose a fraction of such an army.
Zunarit leaned farther forward in his saddle, raised his fist in a threatening manner. His brows pinched over glaring eyes, his nostrils flared.
Then what better reason to smash it now? Afterward, we shall sweep to the great sea like our fathers of yore. We shall pull down their temples, impregnate their daughters, cut down their sons.
To Nayor's alarm, shouts of agreement rifled the morning air. He silenced them with a killing look.
Are you all dog-eyed drunks? What's better reason to let the Nansor languish? What do you think Confis would do if he were in our midst? What? Pick my sword from his ass!
Someone cried out, prompting an explosion of hearty laughter. Nayor could smell it then, the good-humored camaraderie that amounted to little more than a conspiracy to mock one and the same man. His lips twisted into a grimace. Always the same, no matter what his claim to arms or intellect. They'd measured him many years ago and had found him wanting.
But measure is unceasing.
No!
Nayor roared.
He'd laugh at you as you laugh at me. He'd say a dog must be known to be broken, and I know these dogs better than they know themselves.
A plaintive cast had crept into his tone and expression. He struggled to squelch it.
Listen. You must listen. Confess has gambled on this very council, on our arrogance, on our customary thoughts. He's done everything in his power to provoke us, don't you see? We decide his genius on the field. Only we can make him a fool. And by doing the one thing that terrifies him, the one thing he's done everything to prevent. We must wait. Wait for him to come to us.
Zunarit had watched him intently, his eyes bright with gloating amusement. Now he smiled derisively.
Men call you man-killing Nayor. Speak of your prowess on the field, of your endless hunger for holy slaughter. But now,
he shook his head in a scolding manner.
Where's that hunger gone, Utamot? Should we now call you time-killing Nayor?
More heart-gouging laughter, deep-throated and coarse, at once honest in the way of a simple people, and yet bruised by an unsavory glee, the sound of lesser men reveling in the degradation of one greater. Nayur's ears buzzed. Earth and sky shrank until the whole world became laughing, yellow-toothed faces. He could feel it stir within him, his second soul, the one that blotted the sun and painted the earth with blood. Their laughter faltered before his menace. His glare struck even the smirks from their faces.
Tomorrow,
Zunarit declared, nervously yanking his roan toward the distant Nansor encampment,
we shall sacrifice an entire nation to the dead god. Tomorrow we put an empire to the knife.
Swaying silently upon wooden saddles, innumerable horsemen paced through grasses chill and gray with morning dew. Nearly 8 years had passed since the Battle of Zerkerta, 8 years since Nayor had last witnessed such a gathering of the people. Great congregations trailed their chieftains, enveloping slopes and heights nearly a mile distant. Screened by thickets of raised lances, hundreds of horse-hide standards jutted from the masses, marking tribes and federations from across the steppe. So many. Did Ikuri Confess grasp what he'd done? The Skilvendi were fractious by nature, and aside from their ritual border raids on the Nansurium, they spent the majority of their time murdering one another. This penchant for feud in internecine warfare was the Empire's greatest bulwark against their race, greater even than the sky-gutting Hethantus. By invading the steppe, Confis had welded the people together, and so had delivered the Empire to its greatest peril in a generation. What could prompt such a risk? For no apparent reason, Ikuri Zarius III had staked the Empire itself on his precocious nephew. What promises had Confis made him? What circumstances had driven him? All was not as it seemed. Of this, Nayor was certain. And yet, as he stared across fields of armored horsemen, he could not help repenting his earlier misgivings. Everywhere he looked, he saw grim, warlike riders, pelts nailed to their circular shields, their horses caparisoned in skirts stitched with plundered Nansor and Kianine coins. Countless thousands of Skilvendi, made terrible by cruel seasons and never-ending war, now united as in the days of legend. What hope could Confis possibly have? Nansur horns blared from beneath the mountains, startling man and horse alike. All eyes turned to the long ridge that obscured the valley. Nayur's gray snorted and pranced, swishing the scalps that adorned his bridle.
Soon,
he muttered, stilling his horse's romping head with a firm hand.
Soon the madness will break.
Nayor always remembered the hours before battle as unbearable, and because of this, he was always surprised whenever he actually endured them. There were moments when the enormity of what was about to happen seized him, left him stunned, like one who just avoided a mortal fall. But such moments were fleeting. By and large, the hours passed like any others, more anxious, perhaps, and punctuated by flashes of communal hate and awe, but otherwise as tedious as the rest. By and large, he needed to remind himself of the insanity to come. Nayor was the first of his tribesmen to gain the summit of the ridge. Smoldering between two incisor-shaped mountains, the rising sun blinded them, and several moments passed before Nayor could discern the faraway lines of the Imperial army. Phalanxes of infantry formed a great segmented band across the open ground between the river and the fortified Nansor encampment. Mounted skirmishers ranged the broken slopes before them, poised to harass any Skilvendi attempting to cross the Kayuth. As though greeting their ancient foe, the Nansor horns pealed once again, shivering through the raw morning air. A mighty shout rose from the ranks, followed by the hollow drum of swords pounding shields. While the other tribes mustered along the ridgeline, Nayor studied the Nansor, a hand raised against the sun. The fact that they occupied the middle ground rather than the east bank of the river did not surprise him, though he imagined Zunarit and the others were now scrambling to alter their plans. He tried counting the ranks. The formation seemed extraordinarily deep, but had difficulty concentrating. The absurd magnitude of his circumstances weighed against him like something palpable. How could such things happen? How could whole nations? He lowered his head, rubbed the back of his neck, rehearsing the litany of self-recriminations that always consummated such shameful thoughts. In his soul's eye, he saw his father, Sciotha, his face blackening as he suffocated in the muck. When he looked up, his thoughts were as vacant as his expression. Confis, Icuri Confis, was the focus of what was about to unfold, not Nayor Urs Sciotha. A voice startled him. Banut, his dead father's brother.
Why are they deployed so close to their encampment?
The old warrior cleared his throat, a sound like a horse's low-chested knicker.
You'd think they'd use the river to deny us our charge.
Nayor resumed his appraisal of the Imperial army. The giddiness of imminent bloodshed floated through his limbs.
Because Confis needs a decisive battle. He wants us to draw our lines on his side of the river, deny us room to maneuver and force an all-or-nothing confrontation. Is he mad?
Banut was right. Confis was mad if he thought his men could prevail in a pitched battle. In desperation, the Kianin had made a similar bid at Zerkerta 8 years before. They had purchased only disaster. The people did not break. A laugh surfaced through the mutter of his surrounding kinsmen. Nayor jerked his head around.
At him? Did someone laugh at him?
No.
He replied distantly, watching profiles over Banut's shoulders.
Icuri Confis is not mad.
Banut spat, a gesture meant, or so Nayor assumed, for the Nansor Exalt General.
You speak as though you know him.
Nayor glared directly at the old man, trying to decipher the disgust in his tone. He did know Confis, in a manner. While raiding the Empire the previous autumn, he'd captured several Nansor soldiers, men who prated about the Exalt General with an adoration that had captured Nayor's interest. With hot coals and harsh questions, he'd learned much of Icuri Confis, of his brilliance in the Galioth Wars, of his daring tactics and novel training regimens, enough to know he was different from any he'd ever met on the field. But this knowledge was wasted on old snakes such as Banut, who had never forgiven him the murder of his father.
Ride to Zunarit,
Nayor commanded, knowing full well the King of Tribes would have nothing to do with an Utumut messenger.
Find out what he intends.
Banut was not fooled.
I'll take your Salka with me,
he said hoarsely.
He married one of Zunarit's daughters, the deformed one, just last spring. Perhaps the King of Tribes will remember that generosity.
Banut spat one last time, as though to cement his meaning, and spurred into the surrounding Utumut.
For a long time, Naor sat desolate upon his horse, numbly watching bumblebees dart between the bobbing heads of purple clover just below him. The Nansor continued pounding their distant shields. The sun slowly gathered the valley in its hot clasp. Horses stamped in impatience. More horns rang across the interval, and the Nansor ceased their clamor. The rumble of his muttering kinsmen waxed, and a kindling rage crowded the grief from his breast. Always they spoke to one another and never to him. It was as though he were a dead man in their midst. He thought of all those he'd killed the first few years after his father's death, all those Utamot who'd sought to wrest the chieftain's white yaksh from the dishonor of his name. 7 cousins, 1 uncle, and 2 brothers. Stubborn hate brimmed within him, a hate that ensured he would not yield, no matter how many indignities they heaped upon him, no matter how many whispers or guarded looks. He would murder all and any, foe and kinsman alike, before he would yield. He fixed his gaze on the bristling landscape of Confis's army.
"Will I kill you today, Exalt General? I think so."
Sudden shouts drew his attention to the left. Across the congestion of arms and horsemen, he saw Zunarit's standard waving against the sky. Dyed horsetails whisked up and down, relaying the order for a slow advance. Far to the north, crowds of Skilvendi had already begun filing down the slopes. Crying out to his tribesmen, Naor spurred his mount toward the river, trampling the clover and scattering the bees. The dew had burned off, and the grasses now rasped about his horse's shins. The air smelled of warming earth. The Skilvendi horde gradually enveloped the eastern valley. Pressing through the scrub of the floodplain, Naor glimpsed Banut and Yorsalka racing toward him across open ground, their leather bowcases swinging from their hips, their shields bouncing on their horses' rumps. They leapt some scrub, and Banut was nearly unhorsed by a shallow ravine on the far side. Within moments, they were reining their mounts parallel to Naor. For some reason, they seemed even more ill at ease than usual. After a conspiratorial glance at Banut, Yorsalka fixed Naor with expressionless eyes.
"We're to take the southernmost of the forts, then position ourselves opposite the Nasoret column on the enemy's left. If Confis advances before we've reformed, we're to withdraw to the south and harass his flanks."
"Zunarit himself told you this?"
Yorsalka nodded carefully. Banut glared, his old eyes bright with malicious self-satisfaction. Rocking with his horse's gait, Naor peered over the Kayuth, sifting through the crimson banners of the Imperial Army's left. He found the standard of the Nasoret column quickly, the black sun of Nansor halved by an eagle's wing, and the Shaiq symbol for 9 embroidered in gold below. Banut cleared his throat again.
"The 9th column," he said approvingly. "Our king of tribes honors us."
Though traditionally stationed on the Empire's Kianin frontier, the men of the Nasoret were rumored to be among the Imperial Army's finest.
"Either that, or he murders us,"
Naor amended. Perhaps Zunarit hoped hard consequences would follow from the hard words they traded the previous day.
"They all want me dead."
Yorsalka snorted something unintelligible, then spurred away, seeking, Naor imagined, more honorable company. Banut continued at Naor's side, saying nothing. When the Kayuth grew near enough for them to smell its glacial ancestry, several detachments broke from the Skilvendi line and plowed across the river's many fords. Naor watched these cohorts apprehensively, knowing their immediate fortune would reveal much of Confis's intentions. The Nansor skirmishers on the river's far side fell back before them, then broke and bolted, pelted by volleys of arrows. The Skilvendi pursued them toward the bulk of the Imperial Army, then hooked into a gallop parallel to the Nansor line, firing clouds of arrows from the backs of hard-running horses. More and more cohorts joined them, guiding their horses with only spur, cry, and knee. Soon, thousands were sweeping across the Imperial lines. Naor and his Utamot crossed the Kayuth under cover of these marauders, trailing drapes of water as they climbed the far bank, then rode hard to their new position opposite the Nasaret. Nayor knew the river crossing and subsequent redeployment would be a critical time, and throughout he kept expecting to hear horns sound the Nansur advance. But the exalt general kept his columns leashed, allowing the Skilvendi to assemble in a vast crescent along the back of the river. What was Confis doing? Across ground and grasses as uneven as a juvenile's beard, the Imperial army awaited them. Nayor gazed across row after row of shield-bearing figures, heavy with armor and insignia, wearing red leather skirts and iron-banded harnesses trimmed by mail, innumerable and nameless, soon to die for their trespasses. Horns brayed, thousands of swords beat as one, and yet it seemed an uncanny silence had settled upon the field, a collective intake of breath. A breeze funneled through the valley, tugging at the smell of horses, sweaty leather, and unwashed men. The chafe and clank of scabbards against harnesses reminded Nayor of his own armor. His hands as light as air-filled bladders, he checked the straps of his white-enameled battle cap, a trophy of his victory over Hasjinet at Zerkerta, then the lacings of his iron-ringed brigandine. He swung from his waist in his saddle, both to limber his muscles and to ease the tension. He whispered a memorial to the dead god. Horsehair signals were traded between the massed tribes, and Nayor barked commands to his kinsmen. The first wave of lancers formed abreast of him. Shields were strung from necks. Sensing Benut's scrutiny, Nayor turned to him, found himself disquieted by his expression.
"You," the old warrior said, "shall be measured this day, Nayor Uskiotha. Measure is unceasing."
Nayor gaped at the man, overcome by fury and astonishment.
"This is not the place, uncle, to revisit old wounds. I can think of no better place."
Concerns, suspicions, and premonitions beset him, but there was no time. The skirmishers were retiring. In the distance, lines of horsemen peeled away from the greater horde, pacing toward the phalanxes of the Imperial army. The pilgrimage had ended. The worship was about to begin. With a shout, he led the Utamut forward at a trot. Something akin to fear clutched him, a sense of falling as though from a precipice. Within moments, they found themselves within range of the Nansur bowman. He cried out, and his lancers spurred to a gallop, bracing shields against shoulders and saddle horns. They crashed through a thicket of stunted sumacs. The first shafts whistled among them, tearing air like cloth, thudding into shield, ground, flesh. One clipped his shoulder, another punched a finger's length through the laminated leather of his shield. They thundered across a stretch of level turf, gathering fatal momentum. More arrows descended upon them, and they were fewer. Hoarse shrieks, the clatter of shafts, then only the raw rumble of 1,000 hoofs across the turf. His head low, Nayor watched the infantrymen of the Nasaret column brace themselves. Pikes were lowered, pikes longer than any he'd ever seen. His breath caught in hesitation, but he spurred his horse faster, couching his lance, howling the Utamut battle cry. His kinsmen answered, and the air shivered, "War and worship!" Clumped grasses and wildflowers hurtled beneath him. The wall of pikes and shields and soldiers rushed closer. His tribe rode with him, outstretched like two great arms. Taken in the chest, his horse toppled, gouged the steppe grass. He crashed against turf and shins, wrenched his shoulder and neck. For an instant, he was tangled in locked limbs. He winced beneath a great crushing shadow, but nothing came, and he pushed free, tossing away his shield, drawing his sword, struggling to make sense of the confusion around him. Close enough to touch, a riderless horse stamped in wild circles, kicking into the Nansur. It was hacked to death by men packed so tight they seemed hammered together by nails. The Nansur ranks were largely unbroken, and they fought with stubborn professionalism. The Utamut suddenly seemed wild and thin before them, impoverished in their undyed leather and looted armor.
To either side, his kinsmen were being cut down. He saw Okiur, his cousin, pulled from his horse by hooks and cudgeled on the ground. He glimpsed his nephew Maluti thrash beneath falling swords, still shrieking the Utumat battle cry. Had so many already fallen? He glanced at the expanse behind them, expecting to find the second wave of Utumat lancers. Save for a lone horse limping toward the river, the ground was empty. He saw his tribesmen in the distance, milling in their original positions, watching when they should have been riding. What was happening? Treachery? Treachery. He looked about for Banut, found him curled in the grasses nearby, fumbling with his stomach as though he cradled a toy. A Nansur stumbled from the surrounding melee, drew his short sword back to thrust into Banut's throat. Nayur scooped a weighted javelin from the ground and flung it. The soldier saw him, foolishly drew up his shield. The javelin punched through the top corner, dragged the shield down with its weight. Nayur leapt toward him, seized the javelin, then violently heaved shield and man forward. The infantryman lurched to his hands and knees, scrambled beneath Nayur's raised broadsword, then slumped to the ground, headless. Nayur grabbed Banut by the harness and dragged him from the fracas. The old warrior cackled, blood bubbling between his lips.
"Zunarit remembered well the favor your Salka did him," he cried.
Nayur stared at him in horror.
"What have you done? Killed you? Killed the kinslayer, the weeping faggot who'd be our chieftain?"
Horns blared through the uproar. Between heartbeats, Nayur saw his father in Banut's grizzled face. But Sciutha had not died like this.
"I saw you that night,"
Banut wheezed, his voice growing more pinched with agony.
"I saw the truth of what?"
His body cramped and shook about a racking cough.
"What happened so 30 years past? I told all that truth. Now the Utumat will be delivered from the oppression of your disgrace. You know nothing,"
Nayur cried.
"I know all. I saw the way you looked at him. I know he was your lover."
Lover? Banut's eyes were beginning to glass over as though he looked into something bottomless.
"Yours is the name of our shame,"
he gasped.
"By the dead god, I would see it blotted out."
Nayur's blood felt like gravel. He turned away to blink back tears. Weeper. Through a screen of straining, hacking figures, he glimpsed Sakaruth, a childhood friend, topple from his rearing mount. He remembered spearing fish with him beneath broad summer skies. Remembered?
No. Faggot. Is this what they thought? No,
he snarled, turning back to Banut. The old iron rage had at last found him.
I am Nayur Uskiotha, breaker of horses and men.
He speared the turf with his sword and seized the astonished man about the throat.
None have murdered so many, none bear as many holy scars. I'm the measure of disgrace and honor, your measure.
His uncle gagged, flailed at him with blood-oily palms. Then he went slack, strangled, the way the girl children of slaves were strangled. Retrieving his broadsword, Nayur stumbled from his uncle's corpse, looked about vacantly. The carcasses of horses and men embroidered the ground before him. Reduced to clots of unhorsed warriors, his Utumat recoiled from the bristling wall of infantrymen. Several howled to their distant kinsmen, realizing they'd been stranded. A shameless handful broke and ran. Others gathered about Nayur. Imperial officers bawled over the din. The Nansur ranks advanced. With his left hand outstretched before him, Nayur fell into stance, raising his broadsword high until the sun flashed along its smeared length. The infantrymen picked their way over the fallen, their shields emblazoned with black suns, their faces masks of grim jubilation. Nayur saw one spear Banut's body. More hollering broke out among the officers, hoarse over the braying of distant horns. Abruptly, the forward three ranks charged. Neyor fell to a crouch, hacked at the grieved chin of the first man to rush him. The fool went down. He kicked his shield upwards, punched his blade through the bands of his armor just beneath the armpit. Exultation. He jerked his broadsword free, swept around and hacked at another, breaking his collarbone through his harness. Neyor cried out and raised his scarred arms, mighty tokens of his bloody past.
"Who?" he roared in their womanish tongue. "Who among you shall take the knife to my arms?"
A third fell, vomiting blood, but the rest closed on him in numbers, led by a stone-eyed officer who bellowed, "Die!" with every stroke of his sword. Neyor obliged him, shearing away part of his jaw with his lower teeth. Undeterred, the others crowded him with spears and shields, pressing him backward. Another officer rushed him, a young noble with a motif of House Biaxi across his shield. Neyor could see the terror in his eyes, the realization that the hulking Skilvendi before him was something more than human. Neyor swatted the short sword from his feminine hands, savagely kicked him, struck. The boy fell backward, shrieking, slapping at the blood that jetted from his groin as though it were fire. They jostled before him, now as eager to avoid as to close with him.
"Where are your mighty warriors?"
Neyor screamed.
"Show me your mighty warriors!"
His limbs fevered by all-conquering hatred, he cut them down, weak and strong alike, fighting like one mad with heartbreak, hacking shields until arms were broken, pounding figures until they stumbled and spouted plumes of blood. The advancing ranks engulfed them, but still Neyor and his Utamut killed and killed until the turf beneath their feet became bloody muck, treacherous with corpses. The Nansor relented, scrambled back several paces, gaping at the Utamut chieftain. Sheathing his broadsword, Neyor vaulted the bodies heaped before him. He caught a wounded straggler by the throat, crushed his windpipe. Roaring, he heaved the thrashing man above his head.
"I am the Reaver!" he cried. "The measure of all men!"
He sent the body crashing at their feet.
"Is there no cook among you?"
He spat, then laughed at their astonished silence.
"All cunts, then!"
He shook the blood from his mane, raised his broadsword anew. Panicked shouts erupted among the Nansur. Several threw themselves against the men packed behind, mad to escape his deranged aspect. Then rumbling hoofs breached the din of the greater battle, and all heads turned. More Utamut horsemen exploded into their midst, impaling some Nansur on long lances, trampling others. There was a brief moment of pitched melee, and Neyor hammered down two more, his sword now blunted to an edged iron pipe. Then the men of the Nasaret column were fleeing, casting away weapons and shields as they ran. Neyor and his kinsmen found themselves alone, chests heaving, blood streaming from unstanched wounds.
"Ah!"
they cried as cohort after wild cohort galloped by them.
"War and worship!"
But Neyor ignored them, sprinting instead to the top of a low knoll. The valley opened before him, churning with dust, smoke, and countless thousands of warring men. For a moment, the enormity of the spectacle struck him breathless. Far to the north, he saw divisions of Skilvendi horsemen, dark through skirts of dust, wheel, and charge what looked to be a stranded Nansur column. Following the horsehide standard of the Munawati, companies of horsemen streamed east between the isolated column and the center, riding down fleeing men. At first he thought they raced toward the Nansur encampment, but a glance told him this was not so. The camp already burned, and Neyor could see Nansur slaves, priests, and craftsmen dangle and drop from the palisades. Someone had already raised the standard of the Pulut, the southernmost of the Skilvendi tribes, on the forward timber gate. So quickly. He scrutinized the madness of the center. Someone had set the intervening grasses aflame, and through the smoke, He saw Zunarit's Akunahor pressed against the glittering black waters of the Kaiuth, assailed on all sides by the Eothic Guard and elements of a column he could not identify. Dead horses and men littered the great swath of land between his position and Zunarit's desperate stand. Where were the Kuwati, the Alkusi? Nayur turned west, to the far side of the river, the wrong side, and saw a pitched battle along the wrinkled crest of the valley. He identified the Kidrahil, the elite Imperial heavy cavalry, overwhelming a shattered cohort of Skilvendi. He saw Nimbrikani horsemen, the Emperor's Norserai auxiliaries, disappear over a ridge farther north, and the perfect phalanxes of what looked like two intact columns marching in their wake, one of them bearing Nasseret standards. But how could that be? His Utamut had just annihilated the Nasseret. Hadn't they? And hadn't the Kidrahil been positioned on the Nansur's extreme right flank, the position of honor among the Ketye? The position facing the Pullet? He could hear his men call to him, but he ignored them. What was Confis doing? A hand clasped his shoulders. It was Belait, his second wife's eldest brother, someone he'd always respected. The man's corselet had been severed and now hung from one shoulder. He still wore his spiked battle cap, but blood coursed down his left temple, drawing a line through the spatter.
Come, Nayur, he gasped. Osgood has brought us horses. The field is confused. We must reassemble to strike. Something's wrong, Bala, Nayur replied. But the Nansor are doomed. Their camp already burns. Yet they own the center. All the better. The flanks are ours, and what remains of their army has been drawn onto open ground. Even now, Okne Wanai leads his Munuate to relieve Zunarit. We shall close about them as a fist. No, Nayur said blankly, watching the Kidrahil battle their way over the crest behind them. Something's wrong. Confis gave us the flanks so that he could seize the center.
That would explain how the Pullet had taken the encampment so quickly. Confis had withdrawn his Kidrahil at the battle's onset to throw them against the Skilvendi center, and he'd given his columns false standards in order to deceive them into thinking he'd deployed his main strength across his flanks. The Exalt General wanted the center. Maybe, Belait offered. He thought taking the King of Tribes would throw us into disarray.
No, he's not so foolish as that. Look, he's thrown all his horse into the center, as though he chases something.
Nayur worked his jaw, peering across the vista, his eyes sifting through scene after faraway scene of violence. The sharp threshing of swords, the murderous heave and hammer of war's bloody work. And beneath its beauty, something unfathomable, as though the field itself had become a living sign, a pictogram like those the Outlanders used to freeze breath onto stone and parchment. What did it mean? Belait had joined his meditation.
He's doomed, the man said, shaking his head. Not even his gods can save him.
Then Nayur understood. His breath grew chill in his breast. The hot fury of bloodletting abandoned his limbs. He could feel only the ache of his injuries and the unspeakable hollow opened by Banut's words.
We must flee.
Belait stared at him in stunned contempt.
We must what? The Kore bowmen. Confis knows we position them behind the center. Either they are destroyed, or he's chased them from the field. Either way, we...
Then he glimpsed the first flashes of unholy light. Too late.
A school, Bala! Confis has brought a school!
Near the heart of the valley, from infantry phalanxes hastily arrayed to meet Akhnai One-Eye and the Munuati, at least 24 black-robed figures slowly climbed over the field and into the sky. Schoolmen, the sorcerers of the Imperial Sake. Several dispersed over the valley, Those remaining already sang their unearthly song, scorching earth and Skilvendi with shimmering flame. The Munuati charge crumbled into an avalanche of burning horses and men. For a long moment, Neor could not move. He watched mounted silhouettes topple in the heart of golden bonfires. He saw men thrown like chaff by incandescent blooms. He saw suns fall short of the horizon and come crashing to fiery earth. The air resounded with the concussions of sorcerous thunder.
"A trap," he murmured. "The entire battle was a bid to deny us our Kore."
But Neor possessed his own Kore, an inheritance from his dead father. Fingers numb, arms giddy with exhaustion, he pulled the iron sphere from beneath his brigandine and clutched it tight. As though walking across the back of roiling smoke and dust, a schoolman drifted toward them. He slowed, floating the height of a treetop above them. His black silk robe boiled in the mountain wind, its gold trim undulating like snakes in water. White light flashed from his eyes and mouth. A barrage of arrows winked into cinders against his spherical wards. The ghost of a dragon's head ponderously ascended from his hands. Neor saw glassy scales and eyes like globes of bloody water. The majestic head bowed. He turned to Balait, crying,
"Run!"
The horned maw opened and spewed blinding flame. Teeth snapped, skin blistered and sloughed, but Neor felt nothing, only the warmth thrown by Balait's burning shadow. There was a momentary shriek, the sound of bones and bowels exploding. Then the froth of sunbright fire was gone. Bewildered, Neor found himself in the center of burnt ruin. Balait and the other Utamot still burned, sizzling like swine on the spit. The air smelt of ash and pork.
All dead.
A mighty shout braced the cacophony, and through screens of smoke and fleeing Skilvendi, he saw a bloodied tide of Nansor infantrymen rushing toward him across the slopes. A stranger's voice whispered,
"Measure is unceasing."
Neor fled, leaping over the slain, bounding like the others for the dark line of the river. He tripped over an arrow shaft embedded in the turf and slammed headlong into a dead horse. Bracing himself against sun-warmed flanks, he stumbled to his feet and lurched into a sprint. He swept past a young warrior limping with an arrow in his thigh, then another kneeling in the grasses, spitting blood. Then a band of his Utamot rumbled by on horses, led by Yursalka. Neor cried out his name, and though the man momentarily looked at him, they continued riding. Cursing, he pressed harder. His ears roared. He blew spit after every sucking breath. Ahead he saw hundreds massed along the banks, some frantically tearing at their armor so they could swim, others dashing south toward a rapids that promised shallows. Yursalka and his Utamot cohort barreled through the would-be swimmers and crashed into the waters. Many of their horses foundered in the swift current, but a few managed to drag their riders to the far banks. The ground steepened, and Neor swallowed the distance with long, loping strides. He leapt another dead horse, then crashed through a copse of goldenrods wagging in the wind. To his right, he glimpsed a company of Imperial Kidrohil fanning across the slopes and galloping hard toward the fugitives. He staggered across the narrow floodplain, then finally blundered into the panicked midst of his countrymen. He yanked men aside, swatting his way to the muck and trampled brush of the riverbank. He saw Yursalka press through the rushes and urge his sopping mount up the far side. A dozen other Utamot awaited him, their horses half-panicked and stamping.
"Utamot!"
he roared, and somehow they heard him through the clamor. Two of them pointed in his direction, but Yursalka was shouting at them, beating the air with an open hand. Their expressions blank. They jerked their horses about and, hounded by Yursalka, galloped to the southwest. Neor spat at their retreating forms. He grabbed his knife and began sawing at his brigandine. Twice he was almost jostled into the water. Shouts of alarm rifled the air, made urgent by the swelling thunder of hoofs. He heard lances crack and horses shriek. He began stabbing at his brigandine's gut lacings. Bodies heaved against him, and he stumbled. He glimpsed a Kidrahill rider, towering black across the flare of the sun. He tore off his brigandine, whirled to the Kaiuth. Something exploded against his scalp. Hot blood choked his eyes. He fell to his knees. The rutted ground struck his face. Screams, wails, and the sound of bodies plunging into rushing mountain water.
So like my father,
he thought. Then darkness came swirling down. Hoarse, exhausted voices, framed by a more distant and more drunken chorus of singers. Pain, as though his head were nailed to the earth. His body leaden, as immovable as the river mud. Hard to think.
What, do they bloat right after they die?
Lurching horror. The voice had come from behind, very close. Looters?
Another ring,
a second voice exclaimed.
Just saw off the fucking finger!
Nayor heard approaching footsteps, sandaled feet barging through grasses. Slowly, because fast movements drew the eye, he tested his fingers and his wrist. They moved. He gently probed beneath his girdle, closed tingling fingers on his coray, withdrew it, then pressed it into the mud.
He's squeamish,
a third voice observed.
Always has been.
I'm not. It's just...
Just what?
Sacrilege, that's all. Robbing the dead is one thing. Desecrating them is quite another.
Need I remind you,
the third voice said,
that these here are what you call dead skilvendi. Pretty hard to desecrate what's accursed in the first. Ha ha! Another live one here.
The sound of a gritty blade scraping free of its scabbard, a thud, then a choking gasp. Despite his pounding head, Nayur smeared his face in the muck, scooped as much of it as he could bear into his mouth.
Still can't get his blasted ring.
Just chop off the fucking finger, would you?
Cried the second voice, now so close that it raised the hair on Nayur's neck.
By the letter fucking prophet. The only one lucky enough to find gold on these stinking savages, and he's paralyzed by scruples.
Hello, what do we have here? Big brute. Sweet, says Janus, look at the scars on him.
They say Confis wants us to collect all their heads anyway,
the third voice said.
What's a finger matter?
There, a little spit. Do you think these could be rubies?
A rough hand clasped Nayur's shoulder, peeled him from the muck. Eyes half open to the setting sun, limbs tensed in semblance of rigor, soil-choked mouth drawn back in the sardonic grin. No breath.
I'm serious,
a looming shadow said.
Look at the scars on this bastard. He's killed hundreds. They should offer bounties for ones like him. Imagine one of our countrymen for every scar.
Hands rifled his body, patting, poking. No breath. Stiff, motionless.
Maybe we should take him to Gavaris,
the first voice ventured.
They might want to string him up or something. Grand idea, that one,
the shadow said scathingly.
How about you carry him?
A laugh.
Not so grand anymore, is it?
The second voice said.
Any luck there, Naf?
Not a single fucking thing,
the shadow said, tossing Nayur back to the ground.
Next ring you find is mine, you little bastard. Otherwise I saw off your fingers.
A kick from the blackness. Pain unlike any he'd ever experienced. The world roared. He struggled not to vomit.
Sure,
the first voice said amiably.
Who needs gold after a day like this? Imagine the triumph when we return. Imagine the songs. The Skilvendi destroyed on their own land. The Skilvendi! When we're old, we need only say that we served with Confis at Kaiuth, and everyone will regard us with reverence and awe. Glory doesn't get you the good bird, boy. Glitter. It's all in the glitter.
Morning. Nayur awoke shivering. He heard only the deep running wash of the river Kaiuth. A great iron ache radiated from the back of his head, and for a time he lay still, crushed by its weight. Convulsions racked him, and he heaved bile into the footprints before his face. He coughed. With his tongue, he probed a soft, salty gap between his teeth. For some reason, the first clear thought to arise from his misery was of his Koray. He scraped his fingers through vomit and gritty muck, found it quickly. He tucked it beneath his iron-plated girdle.
Mine, my prize.
The pain pressed like a shod hoof against the back of his skull, but he managed to push himself to his hands and knees. The grass was whitewashed with mud and sharp like small knives between his fingers. He dragged himself away from the rush of the river. The turf of the embankment had been trampled into mud, now hardened into the brittle record of the earlier slaughter. The corpses seemed cemented to the ground, their flesh leathery beneath flies, their blood clotted like crushed cherries. He felt as though he crawled across one of those dizzying stone reliefs that paneled the temples of Nansur, where struggling men were frozen in unholy representation. But this was no representation. Cresting the slope before him, a dead horse rose like a rounded mountain range, its belly in shadow, the bright point of the sun rising on the far side. Dead horses always looked the same, ridiculously stiff, as though they were carvings of wood simply tipped on their sides. He pushed himself onto it, rolled painfully over. Against his cheek, it was as cold as the river clay. Save for jackdaws, vultures, and the dead, the battlefield was abandoned. He gazed across the gradual incline over which he'd fled.
Fled.
He clamped shut his eyes. Again and again he was running, the blue sky shrunken by the roar behind him.
We were routed.
Defeated, humiliated by their ancestral enemy. For a long time he felt nothing. He remembered those mornings in his youth when, for whatever reason, he would awaken before dawn. He would creep from the yaksh and steal through the camp, searching for the higher ground where he could watch the sun embrace the land. The wind would hiss through the grasses, the squatting sun would rise, climb, and he would think,
I am the last. I am the only one.
Like now. For an absurd moment, he felt the queer exultation of one who'd prophesied his own destruction. He'd told Zunarit, the eight-fingered fool. They'd thought him an old woman, a spinner of preposterous fears. Where was their laughter now? Dead, he realized. All of them were dead. All of them. The horde had plumbed the horizon with its numbers, had shaken the vault of heaven with the thunder of its advance, and now it was gone. Routed. Dead. From where he lay, he could see great swaths of burned grassland, the burned husks of what had been arrogant thousands, more than routed, massacred. And by the Nansur. Nayor had fought too many borderland skirmishes not to respect them as warriors, but in the end, he despised the Nansur the way all Skilvendi despised them, as a mongrel race. A kind of human vermin to be hunted to extinction if possible. For the Skilvendi, the mention of the empire behind the mountains summoned innumerable images of degradation, leering priests groveling before their unholy tusk, sorcerers trussed in whorish gowns, uttering unearthly obscenities while painted courtiers, their soft bodies powdered and perfumed, committed earthly ones. These were the men who had conquered them. Tillers of earth and writers of words, men who made sport with men. His breath caught on a pain in the back of his throat. He thought of Banut, of the treachery of his kinsmen. He clutched the grass with aching hands, anchors, as though he were so weak, so empty, that he might be blown in an instant into the hollow sky. A forlorn cry uncoiled in his breast but was choked into a hiss by clenched teeth. He gasped air, moaned, rolled his head from side to side despite the agony.
No.
Then he sobbed, wept.
Weeper.
Banut cackling, spitting up milky blood.
I saw the way you looked at him. I know you are lovers.
No! Nayor cried, but his hatred failed him. All these years, pondering their silence, obsessing over the unspoken rebuke in their eyes, thinking himself mad for his suspicions, maligning himself for his fears, and still always pondering their hidden thoughts. How many slanders murmured in his absence? How many times, drawn by the sound of laughter, had he entered a yaksh only to find tight lips and insolent eyes? All this time they'd... He clutched his chest.
No!
He squeezed tears from his eyes, beat a scabbed fist against the turf harder and harder, as though he stoked a furnace. The face from 30 years ago floated before his soul's eye, possessed of a demonic calm.
You task me,
he hissed under his breath.
Heap burden upon burden.
A flare of sudden terror silenced him, the sound of voices carried on the wind. Lying still, with his eyes open only to where his lashes blurred his vision, he listened. They spoke Shaiak, but what they said was indecipherable. Did Luter still range the battlefield?
Fawn-hearted wretch, get up and die.
The wind lulled and the sound swelled. He could hear the step of horses and the periodic rustle of gear. At least 2 men, mounted. The aristocratic inflection in their speech suggested they were officers. They approached, but from what direction? He smothered the mad urge to sit up and look around.
Since the days of Kyrenius, the Skilvendi have been here, the more refined voice was saying. As relentless and as patient as the ocean, and unchanged. Peoples rise and peoples fall. Whole races and nations are blotted out, yet the Skilvendi remain. And I've studied them, Martimus. I've plodded through every report of them I could find, ancient and recent. I even had my agents break into the library of the Sarioths. Yes, and Iothea, though they found nothing. The Fainim have let it crumble to ruin. But here's the thing. Every account of the Skilvendi I read, no matter how ancient, could have been written yesterday. Thousands of years, Martimus, and the Skilvendi have remained unchanged. Take away their stirrups and their iron, and they would be indistinguishable from those who destroyed Metzon 2,000 years ago, or those who sacked Kinae 1,000 years later. The Skilvendi are just as the philosopher Agensis claimed, a people without history.
But so are all illiterate peoples, are they not?
The other man, Martimus, replied.
Even illiterate peoples change over the centuries, Martimus. They migrate. They forget old gods and discover new ones. Even their tongues change. But not the Skilvendi. They're obsessed with custom. Where we raise vast edifices of stone to conquer the passage of years, they make monuments of their actions, temples of their wars.
The description made Neur's heart itch. Who were these men? The one was definitely of the houses.
Interesting, I suppose,
Martimus said. But it doesn't explain how you knew you would defeat them.
Don't be tedious. I despise tedium in my officers. First you ask impertinent questions, then you refuse to acknowledge my answers as answers.
I apologize, Lord Exal-General. I meant no offense. You yourself praise and castigate me for my forthright.
Martimus, always the same charade. The demure general from the provinces without any ambition other than to serve. But I know you better than you think. I've seen your interest quicken when I mention matters of state, just as I see the greed for glory in your eyes now.
It was as though a great stone had been dropped upon Neur's chest. He could not breathe. It was him! Him! Icuri Confus!
I'll not deny it, but I swear I didn't mean to question you. It's just that...
These words brought the 2 men to a stop. Neur could see them now, mounted shadows through the blur of eyelashes. He breathed shallow breaths.
Just what, Martimus?
Through the entirety of this campaign, I've held my tongue. What we did seemed lunacy to me, so much so that...
That what?
That, for a time, my faith in you faltered.
And yet you said nothing? Asked nothing? Why?
Neur tried wrenching himself from the ground, but he could not. In his ears, the disembodied voices had become mocking thunder.
Murder him. He must.
Fear, Lord Exalt-General. One does not rise from the bottom as I have without learning the lethality of questioning one's betters, especially when they're desperate.
Laughter.
So, now, surrounded by this.
Confis's shadow gestured to the fields of ruined dead.
You assume I'm no longer desperate. You think it's safe to ask these festering questions of yours.
A sudden awareness of himself and his environment struck Neor. It was as though he saw himself from far away, a cringing man huddled next to the body of a horse, surrounded by ever-widening circles of dead. Even these images triggered recriminations. What kind of thoughts were these? Why must he always think one thought too many? Why must he always think?
Kill him.
Exactly, Martimus replied.
Rush them. String their horses. Cut their throats in the confusion.
Should I indulge you?
Confis continued.
Should I allow you one more step toward the summit, Martimus?
My loyalty and discretion, Lord Exalt General, are yours without reservation.
I'd already assumed as much, but I thank you for the reassurance. What would you say if I told you the battle we've just fought, the glorious victory we've just won, is nothing more than the first engagement of the Holy War?
The Holy War? The Shriar's Holy War?
Whether the Holy War is the Shriar's or no is the very point at issue.
Move. Avenge yourself. Your people.
But what about...
I'm afraid it would be irresponsible for me to disclose more, Martimus. Soon, perhaps, but not now. My triumph here, as magnificent, as divine as it is, will be sackcloth and ashes compared with what follows. Soon all the three seas will celebrate my name, and then... Well, you're more soldier than officer. You understand that oftentimes commanders require their subordinates' ignorance as much as their knowledge.
I see. Well, I suppose I should have expected this.
Expected what?
That your answers would stoke rather than sate my curiosity.
Laughter.
Alas, Martimus, if I were to tell you all I know, you'd still suffer the same deficit. Answers are like opium. The more you imbibe, the more you need, which is why the sober man finds solace in mystery.
At the very least, you might explain to me, dullard that I am, how you could have known we'd win.
As I said, the Skilvendi are obsessed with custom. That means they repeat, Martimus. They follow the same formula time and again. Do you see? They worship war, but they have no understanding of what it truly is.
And what, then, is war truly?
Intellect, Martimus. War is intellect.
Confis spurred his horse ahead, leaving his subordinate to wrestle with the import of what he'd just uttered. Neyor watched Martimus remove his plumed helmet, run a hand through his cropped hair. For a breathless moment, he seemed to stare directly at him, as though he could hear the thrum of Neyor's hammering heart. Then he abruptly spurred after his exalt general. As Martimus closed on him, Confis called out,
"This afternoon, when our men have recovered from their revels, we start collecting Skilvendi heads. I'm going to build a road of trophies, Martimus, from here to our great diseased capital of Momim. Think of the glory!"
Their voices faded, leaving only the rush of cold waters against buzzing silence and the pale smell of chopped turf. So cold. The ground was so cold. Where should he go? He had fled his childhood and had crawled into the honor of his father's name, Sciotha, chieftain of the Utamot. With his father's shameful death, he'd fled and crawled into the name of his people, the Skilvendi, who were the wrath of Lokung, more vengeance than bone or flesh. Now they too had died, shamefully. There was no ground left to him. He lay nowhere, among the dead. Some events mark us so deeply that they find more force of presence in their aftermath than in their occurrence. They are moments that rankle at becoming past, and so remain contemporaries of our beating hearts. Some events are not remembered. They are relived. The death of Neyor's father, Sciotha, was such an event. Neyor sits in the gloom of the chieftain's great yaksh, as it stood 29 years ago. A fire waxes in its center, bright to look at, but illuminating little. Draped in furs, his father speaks to the other ranking tribesmen about the insolence of their Kuwoti kinsmen to the south. In the shadows thrown by the hard men, Slaves loiter nervously, bearing skins of gishrut, fermented mare's milk. When a horn is raised by a scarred arm, they refill it. The enclosure reeks of smoke and sour liquor. The white Yaksh has seen many such scenes, but this time, one of the slaves, a Norserai man, abandons the shadows and steps into firelight. He lifts his face and addresses the astonished tribesmen in perfect Skilvendi, as though he himself were of the land.
I would make you a wager, chieftain of the Utamot.
Nayur's father is dumbstruck, both by such insolence and by such a transformation. A man hitherto broken has become as august as any king. Only Nayur is not surprised. The other men, who hedge the dark, fall silent. From across the fire, his father replies,
You have already made your gambit, slave, and you have lost.
The slave smiles derisively, as though a sovereign among a callow people.
But I would wager my life with you, Sciotha.
A slave, speaking a name. How it overturns the ancient ways, upends the fundamental order. Sciotha gropes through this absurdity and finally laughs. Laughter makes small, and this outrage must be made small. Fury would acknowledge the depth of this contest, would make one a contestant, and yet the slave knows this. So the slave continues.
I have watched you, Sciotha, and I have wondered at the measure of your strength. Many here so wonder, did you know this?
His father's laughter trails. The fire wheezes softly. Then Sciotha, fearing to look into the faces of his kinsmen, says,
I have been measured, slave.
As though fueled by these words, the fire flutters bright and presses farther into the pockets of darkness between the assembled men. Its renewed heat bites at Nayur's skin.
But measure, the slave replies, is not something accomplished and then forgotten, Sciotha. Old measure is merely grounds for the new. Measure is unceasing.
Complicity makes unforgettable, carves scenes with unbearable clarity, as though the extent of condemnation is to be found in the precision of detail. The fire so hot that it might be cradled in his lap, the cold of the earth beneath his thighs and buttocks, his teeth clenched as though grinding sand. And the Norserai slave's pale face turning to him, the blue eyes bright, more encompassing than any sky, summoning eyes, eyes that yoke, that speak.
Do you remember your part?
Nayur has been given a script for this moment. From among the seated men, he says,
Are you afraid, father?
Mad words, treacherous and mad. A stinging look from his father. Nayur lowers his eyes. Sciotha turns to the slave and asks with contrived indifference,
What then is your wager?
And Nayur is gripped by the terror that he might die, fear that the slave, Anasarimber Moengus, might die. Not his father, Moengus. Afterward, when his father lay dead, he had wept before the eyes of his tribe, wept with relief. At last, Moengus, the one who had called himself Dunyane, was free. Some names mark us so deeply. 30 years, 120 seasons, a long time in the life of one man. And it meant nothing. Some events mark us so deeply. Nayur fled. After darkness fell, he skulked between the shining fires of the Nansur patrols. The vast, hollow bowl of night seemed something he might plummet into, so great was the land's rebuke. With his own feet, the dead chased him.